nice to see you again. We are returning this week to our journey through culture, thinking about media communication in relation to culture and cultural approaches, a discussion we started in week 5, which might sound a bit distant to you at the moment, but hopefully it will come back in an interesting way. And I'm sure it will come back, the issue of culture will come back in very interesting and provocative ways when we hear our two guest speakers. So, 2 weeks ago we started our conversation by focusing on the role of culture in building London's global reputation. Remember, the branding of the city as an imagined mediated place which we want to live, which we want to visit, perhaps to study, and especially to consume. Part of the cultural interface of the city is its creative talent, the human capital of the arts, as some of the political economy scholars you have come across this week would come to say. The creative that expands across all quarters of the city makes it interesting, unpredictable, and open, an open cultural space, as Walter Benjamin would say. Stuart Hall, also who you've been reading for this course, would add that identity and difference associated with creativity is what makes the city an important, powerful, political, and exciting cultural space. Today we have the chance to address some of these questions, to reflect some of these issues, the relation of culture to the city, culture to identity and creativity, by engaging with some of the creative, exciting voices of the global city, of the City of London, and to think about these arguments in a more creative way through their creative work. So feel free to interrogate them when the time comes, but also please listen and think through their work. So before we come to our discussion, we'll hear what our two guest speakers have to say about the ways in which identity, difference, and the city fit into their work, but also how their work might fit into London itself, what the city is about, how it is lived and imagined, especially through culture, production, and creativity. They will start by presenting some of their works, and in visual and oral versions, and you're invited to reflect on those and then ask them your questions. So, as we start, let me present the two speakers for today. Cécile Emigan is sitting there, is a director, writer, and artist from London. She's most known for the global online documentary series Strolling and the short film web series Aki and Saltfish, with her work featured anywhere in many places such as the New York Times, the Washington Post, Ebony Magazine, Fader, Nylon Days, Afropunk, OK Africa, and the Tribeca Film Festival. Dean Atta is a writer and performance poet. He's sitting close to me. He has been commissioned to write poems for the Damilola Taylor Trust, Keith House Museum, National Portrait Gallery, Tate Britain, and Tate Modern. Atta won the 2012 London Poetry Award and was named as one of the most influential LGBT people by the Independent on Sunday, Pick List 2012. His debut poetry collection, I'm Nobody's Nigger, which is there on his table, was published in 2013 by the Westbrook Press, and I'm very excited actually that he's here. For a personal reason as well, I have quoted in full one of his poems that he's reciting today in my book, and it was a very influential piece of work for my work. So it's a very exciting panel for me, and I'm sure it will be for you as well. So without further ado, I pass the word to Cécile to introduce herself and her work.
Hello. Hi, I'm Cécile. So I'm a filmmaker, I'm a director, and a writer primarily. I think the easiest way to kind of explain my work would be to show it. So I'm just going to show a little clip of part of a web series I made called Strolling, which is a documentary series which documents the kind of oral history and stories of black people in the diaspora in different countries and cities. This particular one was filmed in London. This is Kareem, so we're going to watch a little bit of that now.
Thank you. being on chat rooms and stuff when I was like 15 on MSN Messenger, sending like the most outrageous group chat messages to people. I was an only child for 18 years, so the internet and my mom, I credit as the forces that raised me. I've left my own devices a lot. That has really, really, really shaped my interest now. More than like, what, 10 years now of life on the internet. Having to think about maybe how we present ourselves to the wider world from a younger age, it changes your perception. The internet has changed people's perception of themselves and each other. Through the internet, I even understood what diaspora meant. A global blackness. I think I just got like a much better understanding of social and people set up. How so many things are a set up, and the things we are constructed, like race, or homophobia, or sexism. You meet other people who are nurturing those little, small, budding seeds that you're kind of thinking, wait, this isn't right. When I was at uni, I spent half of my time, you know, on Tumblr, on Twitter, venting. This space, this digital space was mine, and I could put anything I wanted to on it. I could say what I wanted, I could write what I wanted, I could delete anything that I regretted to have. You know, that space is mine. Everybody should feel entitled to their own space, because it's so important for growing plan. That's exactly what I feel like. Having such an early exposure to the internet has done for me. I built up a confidence that maybe it was online first, and then translated it into IRL. You should never be made to feel like you can't reach out and connect to somebody. And I feel like the internet really encourages that when somebody that you like has tweeted something that's just real shit. You want them to know that you understand where they're coming from. And half the time they don't know. They think they're talking out of their heart. It's community online basically. One main part of that as well is that we've actually started to do things together. First it starts with dialogue, and then they become fully realized physical spaces. One then starts to inform the other. People can say that online spaces aren't real. They give jokes, you know. Most of the ones that say that to me, or the ones that try to push shade, are clearly, like, they see something that they want. They see somebody who, against all odds, has transcended physical boundaries, has transcended geography, and has still found a community, has still found a safe space. It's an elitist concept, basically. I feel like people who shit on the internet are people who are already comfortable with making connections in art gallery spaces, are already comfortable at the openings and the events, and have the disposable income, the membership cards, and the rare hair tears, yeah. They already feel safe. That, you know what I'm saying? They don't have that sense of disruption. They don't have that radical outlook on things because they already feel comfortable. It's not for everybody, but the ones that it is for, let them have it. You know what I mean? We're doing grassroots work, and it started in a free domain, you know, outside of an institution. And I think that's what scares people the most about the internet, how the internet is part of everybody's lives. And fortunately, people of color, it helps us to mobilize. That's what scares them. It scares them. It helps us organize each other. It helps us communicate with each other. The first thing that they want to do, that oppressors want to do, is stop you from communicating with some another oppressed person. Because then, instead of two confused people who don't have to speak to each other, you have two people who are on the same page, on the same wavelength, and are ready to fuck shit up.
So that's a little clip of Strolling, which is a documentary series. So that was one of the first things I started creating early on in my career, working in the online space, working with web series. And other than Strolling, I have also made a short film that's online and a web series called Acting Selfish, which is a comedy, which is very, very different feel to Strolling, which I'm developing as a full-length series for the BBC at the moment. So I work in different spaces, not just documentary, mainly film, fiction, short films, feature films. So that's a little overview of what I do.
Thank you. Before we move to Dean, can I just ask you about the online spaces? You know, we've heard a lot from your interview there. You mentioned that you have started working on online space. What is particularly important about the online space? I mean, we heard a lot of from your interviewee about the potentials of online space for emancipation, for identity, for organization. What has it done for you and your work?
I think for Stroll in particular, it's made a conversation that is normally exclusive to like academic or maybe more elite institutions, that's made it more accessible. You can just it's made it more informal, it's made it more it's been part of making it a much more accessible conversation for everyone to be a part of. I think the online space allows that. The only thing, it's I think kind of like what Kareem mentioned, it's kind of a democratic space. All you need to do is have the internet. You don't have to have any kind of specialist access or connections to be able to go on the internet and watch something. So for Strolling in particular, which is trying to document conversations of the Black diaspora in particular, I think it was important because a lot of times Black culture is confined to institutions in terms of art and film and stuff. For example, you need to go to like the BFI archives to watch the Black Audio Film Collective, who were a group of filmmakers, Black British filmmakers in the 80s. So I think when you compare it like that, you can kind of see that this online space is allowing people's work like myself to be a little bit more accessible and to have that conversation in like a broader context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what has it done for you as a media professional, for your career? I mean, obviously, you just said that your series has now been commissioned for the BBC.
Yeah, so it's been, of course, it gives you visibility. It allows you to build up your own audience, though I don't really think of it like that because it wasn't like a calculated plan. It was just more like organic, like sharing, and it's just kind of spread. But it's given a lot of visibility, which is meant that more people know about my work, which has granted me opportunities. So yeah, in that sense, that's also great. Where maybe that wouldn't have happened, maybe that hasn't happened for other people, you know, the generation before me who didn't have the internet. For me, it's kind of opened up some other doors that might not have been open.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure people might want to come back to that. How do you manage, you know, from one of the many, of the million of projects that people put develop online, how do you manage to reach out audiences and then possibly media organizations? But I will leave it here. People might want to come back to that later in the Q&A. And I will pass to Dean to share his readings.
I think we'll start with a video. So this is a video of the poem that features in this book. It's a poem I wrote in 2012, which has been animated, so we're going to show you the animated version of it now.
I am nobody's nigger. Rappers, when you use the word nigger, remember that's one of the last words Stephen Lawrence heard, so don't tell me it's a reclaimed word. I am nobody's nigger. So please, let my ancestors rest in peace, not turning their graves in Jamaican plantations, or the watery graves of the slave trade, thrown overboard into the Middle Passage just for insurance claims. They were chained up on a boat, as many as they could manage and stay afloat, stripped of dignity and all hope, awaiting their masters and European names, but the sick and the injured were dead weight to toss, and Lloyd's of London would cover that cost. I am nobody's nigger, so you can tell Wheezy and Drake that they made a mistake. I am nobody's nigger now, so you can tell Kanye and Jigga I am not a nigger in Paris. I'm not a nigger in London, I'm not a nigger in New York, I'm not a nigger in Kingston, I'm not a nigger in Accra, or a nigger with attitude and competence, because I don't want to be called young nigger. How were you raised on public enemy, and still the name of your own worst enemy? You killed hip-hop and resurrected headless zombies that can't think for themselves or see where they're going or quench the blood lust because there's no blood flowing in their hearts, just in the streets. They don't give a damn as long as they're eating. Their hearts ain't beating, they're as cold as ice cream because they would put money over everything. Money over self-respect or self-esteem or empower the youth to follow their dreams. Stacking paper because it's greater than love, it seems. call me nigger, because you're scared of what brother means. To know that we share something unspeakable. To know that as high as we rise, we are not seen as equal. To know that racism is institutional thinking. And that nigger is the last word you heard before a lynching.
So that poem was one that I wrote in 2012, went on to be the title poem of my poetry collection, and also went on to feature in other places. So that poem itself kind of had a life of its own. Because I shared it online, it meant that a lot of the work was out of my hands. I put that poem out there, and then what people did with it, including that animation, I didn't know about until it was done. But luckily I was happy about that when it was completed. I'm sure my publisher knew that my poem ended up in this book, but again, I didn't know about that until today, which is really, really cool. It just shows how the internet can be, you know, such an opportunity for collaboration, even without your knowledge. And I really enjoy collaborating. So for my next collection, I'm having an illustrated book, and I just wanted to share some pieces from my new collection because I think they speak to this idea of culture really well. So the artist that you'll be seeing the work by is Ben Connors, and he did the cover for the book, and because I liked it so much, it got so many comments that I was like, Ben, let's do something together all the way through. And so the first poem is called The Black Flamingo, and it's set in Cyprus, where my mother's family are from, and it's short and it's true. Your grandfather draws your attention to the news. The story, a black flamingo has landed on the island. An expert on screen explaining it is the opposite of an albino. Too much melanin, he says. Camera pans across the salt lake, full of pink. But the eye is drawn to that one black body in the flamboyance. This poem's called The Mix-Up. Cypriot relatives called me the black one. Jamaican family called me English boy. And here I am asked, where are you from? Not Cypriot and not Jamaican. My British passport lays my strongest foundation. Parts of me are still lost at sea, shackled to painful memories. Parts of me are bullet holes in abandoned buildings in a more than thrice conquered Mediterranean island. British soldiers patrol my border. Racism is rarely a downpour. You never know whether to put up your umbrella for the drizzle. But when you get home, you realise you are soaking wet. Before I read the next one, who gets asked a lot, where are you from? Who gets that question, yeah? And who sometimes finds people are not satisfied with the first answer you give them? Yeah. So I wanted to give many answers to that question. So this poem is called I Come From. I come from shepherd's pie and Sunday roast, jerk chicken and stuffed vine leaves. I come from travelling through my taste buds but loving where I live. I come from a home that some would call broken. I come from DIY that never got done. I come from waiting by the phone for him to call. I come from waving the white flag to loneliness. I come from the rainbow flag and the Union Jack. I come from a British passport and an ever-ready suitcase. I come from jet fuel and fresh coconut water. I come from crossing oceans to find myself. I come from deep issues and shallow solutions. I come from a limited vocabulary, but an unrestricted imagination. I come from a decent education and a marvellous mother. I come from being given permission to dream, but choosing to wake up instead. I come from wherever I lay my head. I come from unanswered questions and unread books, unnoticed effort and undelivered apologies and thanks. I come from who I trust and who I have left. I come from last year, and I don't notice how I've changed. I come from looking in the mirror and looking online to find myself.
I come from stories, myths, legends and folk tales. I come from lullabies and pop songs, hip-hop and poetry. I come from griots, grandmothers and her storytellers. I come from published words and stranger smiles. I come from my own pen, but I see people torn apart like paper, each a story or a poem that never made it into a book. And the last poem I'll read today is called British Citizenship Test. And this was a commission by Dazed and Confused magazine. So they asked me to write a poem about what it means to be British, or what it means to me to be British. And I had a friend who had to take one of these citizenship tests recently, and she told me about it, so it made me think about that idea, and I wrote this. The Guardian ran a sample online. I got 9 out of 10 questions right. It didn't say which ones I got wrong, but it was of no consequence to me. My passport, Burgundy and well-used, border control is merely a formality. Never afraid of being refused entry, Britain has always been home to me. Britain is my cluttered Wembley home. It needs a lick of paint in most places. It needs cleaning a little more often. The television stays on a bit too long. Broken things have a unique charm. You find a way of getting used to them, a way to shut the door or turn the tap that most visitors would find bizarre. I imagine what the questions would be if my home had its own citizenship test. What year did the toilet seat break? How many games consoles in the loft? List the books in all 4 bookcases. I would be impressed if you did know, but more concerned with offering you a cup of tea. Ask if you were hungry. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. The last poem actually reminded me of a research project that we actually performed in the same room when we asked the audience to fill in the British citizenship test. And about half of the people passed, and the percentage was about the same between British people and non-British people. But of course, you're in a different position when you're British and when you hold certain passports. So, again, just one question for you before I open the floor for questions from the students. You said that you put your work out there. Largely, you do that online, and that's how I discovered you. And I wonder, why do you put your work out there? In a way, you put it, obviously, as a poet, as a creative person, but it seems also such a powerful political work. So is this also a political project, a project of identity? How do you see your work?
It is a project of identity. I mean, in the way that I know I have a voice. You know, I've been very lucky to be encouraged to speak up for myself from a very young age. And I did that through poetry, but also just through being very argumentative, you know, asking lots of questions and just, you know, had a strong sense of justice as a child. And so that kind of comes through in my work, I think. And being confident enough to go up on stages and read poetry to audiences of strangers is something that I feel really lucky to be able to do. But also having this online world that people can just access your work without necessarily the need for you to put yourself physically out there. So sometimes I'll put new pieces out online because I just want to see what response I get. And sometimes I'll put pieces online because I've already been out there performing them and getting a really good response. So I want to reach a wider audience with those. So for me, the writing is just about kind of figuring out who I am and what I have to say about what I see in the world and how I experience the world. And the confidence just came from my mum just always, you know, telling me I had the right to speak about whatever I wanted to. So just that kind of confidence, I found that a lot of people don't have, you know, don't feel that they're entitled to an opinion. And so not least a book, you know. So some people are like, oh my gosh, you've got a book. And I was like, well, yeah, but I've been writing and I've got enough poems for a book, so I put a book out there. That's kind of how it works. But I think for a lot of people, there's a lot of barriers to feeling like your story is worth telling. Mm. You know, this could read as just my diary. You know, I publish my diary if you want. But actually, no, it's a political statement, and it's an identity that doesn't get a lot of airtime. You know, a black gay person doesn't really get a lot of time on screens or online in a kind of official spaces. So we have to create our own. But sometimes, you know, the official spaces, once you've built up your own momentum and following, they'll start inviting you in, which I found once my work was out there online and stuff. I got the BBC come and ask me to read on the radio, and I got Channel 4 ask me to do poems on there. And so these things come in Dazed and Confused magazine. But that was once I'd already built up my own momentum. And so you've got to just... yeah, be confident about what you have to say. If you believe in it, you've just got to put it out there. And if you get knockbacks or arguments from people, you know, just engage in that dialogue, see what happens and see if it changes your mind. And if it makes you stronger in your convictions, then just keep on doing it.
Thank you. Thank you. So I'm sure there is a lot to follow up. So the floor is open. Any questions and comments? There's a rolling mic going around. So please put your hand up.
I found negative comments never really come directly to me. I do, if my stuff is posted maybe on a blog or a website or even, you know, on some YouTube, when my poem was on SBTV, that poem, I'm Nobody's Nigger, and I've got another poem that was online called Young Black and Gay, and they both got a lot of kind of controversial comments under the video itself. But any comments that came directly to me were wholly positive. It was really interesting. I didn't get attacked personally, though people felt they could use the comment spaces on under videos to say what they wanted. And they can, you know, that space is free space. Like, I don't feel... Even if they said stuff directly to me, I wouldn't feel harassed, but I wouldn't necessarily feel inclined to reply always. You know, depending on how I feel their attack is framed, you know, I might not see it as attack, I might see it as constructive criticism about or something I hadn't thought of before. But so far I don't get stuff directly to me that kind of challenges my work. The people that contact me say they like the work or they've shared the work or that, you know, they're writers too, will I read their blogs and stuff like that. So that's what I get mostly.
Yeah, I'm quite similar to Dean in that sense. It's like people don't really like harass me personally, but yeah, comments, you get loads of negative things. I mean, it's actually funny you mentioned that because recently someone made like a video response to one of the Strolling episodes, and then like a flood of like racist comments just like came in all of those. I had to like disable the comments because it was just like annoying. So, but yeah, like... unfortunately, I think a lot of black people of colour, like, you're not used to it, but you kind of predict that once a certain audience like realizes your work exists, that they're gonna like have a problem with it. But oh well, like not their relevance, it's fine. Yeah.
Oh, please, yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Got the mic.
Okay. So I have a question for Cecile and about the gentleman in your video that's coming to mind on the internet, and maybe coming to collaborate and form identities together. But we're learning about things in class right now, and I was just wondering if you ever asked him about how like we're using the internet to collaborate, but also how it further institutionalizes these communities and how it also helps to shape their identity as well. And the people who own these platforms are also the same people that are suppressing the cultures as well. Do you know what I mean?
I think I know what you mean.
Yeah,
he didn't. I don't think he spoke about that in this episode in particular, but I think what he was referring to, I guess when you were saying that, like, because he mentioned Tumblr and like Twitter and stuff like that. Yeah, he didn't speak about that, but I think that's something that people have been increasingly like speaking about, the fact that like we're putting, you know, when you use these platforms, you're in a sense, putting content into a space that you don't own. But yeah, I don't have a particular view on that. I can see why it's an issue, but I can also see, kind of like what Kareem said, how it's been beneficial for some people who don't have any space. So yeah, but it'd be interesting to see his response. I'm not sure what he would say.
Really quickly, would you say it's
I would just say it's just really, it really depends on the person's situation. I think for some people, maybe it's like a really negative space and it doesn't help them at all. Some people, Kareem must be one of those people, it's been really beneficial and really helpful. So yeah, I don't really have like a blanket statement, like it's good or bad. I just think if it works for you, I think like you said, if it works for you, like have it. If it doesn't, don't.
Oh, a couple of questions. Let's go one, two. Oh, you're too fast.
So I have two different questions on Cecile, one for Dean. Cecile, I was wondering what kind of first motivated you to start putting your stuff out there on YouTube. And for Kareem, sorry, oh gosh, Dean.
It's okay.
You talk about being black and being gay. And I was wondering if people, when they talk to you, do they kind of isolate those two types of identities, but do they talk a bit more about the intersections between the two of them, and how do you see the intersection between those two identities as well?
When I start putting stuff online, I think often when you create something artistic, it's an expression of yourself, and sometimes I think you want other people to witness that or like share it with them. So it just came from wanting to share it with people. Obviously at the beginning it was like just my friends that watched it, and then it just kind of grew. So yeah, I wasn't necessarily going into it thinking I'm going to build an online audience and I'm going to do this and that. I just wanted to share it with whoever wanted to kind of engage with the work.
We were joking before the talk about how busy we've been in October, because it's Black History Month here in the UK, and so and I've noticed already I'm getting bookings for February, which is LGBT History Month, and so I do know that those identities that I hold kind of have their time and place in society, which I play into sometimes, but I also am fully me all the time. So whatever space I'm invited to, whether it's October, February, or any other time of the year, I'm going to bring my whole self there. So sometimes I might drop it in even if it didn't feel relevant to the question I was asked or the talk I was given, but sometimes I just want to put it out there just to kind of see what the audience make of it, because you can see I'm black but you can't see I'm gay. But I just think as a queer person of colour, I just like to kind of put that out there as much as possible, just to see what people's responses are to it. It features a lot in my work, but more than that, it just features in my life. It's my everyday existence. So as much as they are constructs, they are also lived experiences, do you know what I mean? And so I try to kind of respect those communities, because I feel like a lot of my opportunities came initially from those communities or speaking about those communities. And sometimes I share something with you. I wasn't sure, but I watched some comedy last night, like, and it was three stand-up comedians, and one was gay, one was disabled, and one was an Asian man. And the gay comic spoke all about being gay, and the disabled lady spoke all about being disabled. And the Asian guy, just before he started, I said to my mum, "Do you think his comedy is going to be all about being Asian?" And it wasn't. He didn't mention it once, and I was like, "That's really interesting." And there was a weird part of me that kind of respected him more for just doing jokes. And then I thought, I wonder what people think when I come up to speak and do my poetry and it's all about being black and being gay. And I don't apologise for that, but it's just interesting to see someone who's not with your identity, how they feel about you speaking about your identity all the time. And that just, yeah, really had got me wondering whether I could even write stuff that doesn't mention my sexuality or my race in any way or hint at it at all. Could I do that? So that was just really interesting for me to think about, and that was just yesterday. I was thinking about that with my mum, so yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, can I see, sorry, an indication of hands, because we might take a couple of questions together. Okay, can we get two questions together, you guys, and then we'll move forward? Yeah. Hold on. Let's get the second question.
So you mentioned you're British, aren't you? So how far would you say Britain as a whole has come in terms of accepting different cultures, backgrounds, ethnicity? Like, for example, the United States. Do you compare the two, perhaps, and say which has come from first?
Gosh. Cecile, do you want to go first?
Which question, the first one or the second one?
Both. I think you can choose if you want to transport both or
none. So your question about people at the BBC and stuff like that. I definitely think they do, but I think as someone who's going, if you're someone who's going to be working with this kind of people, you have to really know exactly what it is you want to do and just like learn how to say no to people. And know how to just set people straight. So I've definitely had people try to kind of project their ideas and stuff onto my work, and it's just a simple like, no, you're wrong. That's not what it's about. You have to set them straight. But of course, that's like frustrating. But yeah, just realizing that you're allowed to be very, very like stern and like, no, this can't change. Sorry, the end of the conversation kind of thing. I've found. But I don't want to make it sound like it's really simple, because I'm sure there's loads of people who've come and gone that maybe we've never even seen their work come out, that try to kind of navigate that space. I think for me, the having my work online, people like read interviews I've said and stuff online before working with me. So I think the BBC and like other people I work with, they kind of already have an idea that I'm not gonna like make a comedy about black people on the state, like selling drugs. Like, they already know, like, if they come to me with that, it's like, it's gonna get ugly, so they just don't want it. So, yeah, I think you just have to kind of go in there and just be willing to say no, and just be very adamant in that.
Yeah, I'd kind of echo some of that. I think, given that we've both had the opportunity to kind of figure out the type of artist and the type of person we are before kind of reaching those mainstream platforms, I think it means you're a bit more confident, because you know you've already got an audience and you're not necessarily like begging the BBC for their audience. You just think, if they want to collaborate, let's see what we can do, you know. And so it's just more about just them meeting me where I'm at and me kind of understanding what boxes they have to tick, you know. But I think just for virtue of me being there, they've ticked a couple of boxes, so they kind of give me a bit of leeway with what I want to do on that platform. And then I can't really compare Britain and America, because I mean, I've only been to America twice. I've been to New York and to Texas to give readings and to work in schools and stuff. But I what I see online, I kind of not in a rush to go back to America. Not that Britain is great, like in a lot of racial issues, but you know, I'm British by virtue of just being British. It's not a choice, really. Like, I'm here, and you know, both Cyprus and Jamaica were colonized at different points, and that's what drew my grandparents here later on. And so, you know, Britain came to us, you know, before we then came here. So I kind of think I'm just here, I'm making the most of being here, and I'm making the most of the freedom of speech I have from this place, you know, and the fact that I can be my whole self here. I do feel that, you know. I don't feel very limited in what I can say and express, but maybe I'm not radical enough. I sometimes think no one's trying to silence me, so maybe I'm not saying dangerous enough stuff, because yeah, I do. Do you ever have that concern that sometimes you say things people want to hear, or you're not actually pushing things as far as you could because you want to like go slow?
I know what you mean. Yeah. I don't worry about it too much because I don't know. I guess that's a thought, but I try to always just be open, and like I think I always know in the back of my head that I'll never like know enough things, and I'll never reach perfection. It's not possible. So I kind of always know that I'm invaluable, that I'll probably get things wrong, and that like in 5 years I'll probably look back to now and be like, oh my god, what you said was nonsense. Like the same way 5 years ago I think what I was saying was nonsense. So I know what you mean, but I think it's like hard to know in the moment what in the future you might look back on and be like,
I mean, I've had that already with like, you know, I published this book two years ago, and I wrote a poem that was very fresh that went straight into the book about the riots, the London riots, and if we call them riots, it depends how you see it, right? But like when I read it back, I'm like, you didn't really understand what you're talking about, like, and that, you know, it upsets me a bit, but at the same time, that's how I felt at the time of writing it, and I think I polarized the issue a bit too much in the poem that I wrote, and I didn't really. I could have done without just saying nothing on the issue if I didn't have anything really to add to the conversation, but I thought I did. Do you know when? And sometimes you just got to do your best. You got to say what you feel is the right thing at the time. If you make a mistake, then you know you retract or you write something else, or you kind of just do some better work, you know. And so I just try with each piece I write to do my best and be honest to what I know and how I feel at the time. You know, and if I learn more and change my have a change of heart, then you just kind of deal with it, don't you?
Yeah. Just to add on to that, I love seeing artists or just people who you see them grow and change their mind. Like I remember when I first read Malcolm X's autobiography, when he was like in the Nation of Islam to like when he was out of it, he was so different. And I remember like there was like a part in the book where he just like openly admitted he was like so wrong about a lot of stuff, and this made me respect him so much more. And it just kind of affirmed me in that like you can say how you feel right now, and like it's okay if next year you look back and think, no, that was not cute, like, no. But like it's just like you said, like feeling like you're entitled to speak and grow. You don't have to be like this infallible like savior, like pinnacle of success person. Yeah.
That's why we ask our students to be reflexive always in their work. So let's take a couple of more questions from this side. I know we had a couple of questions here, and then we'll come on this side as well. I know you have a question and someone there. Yeah, please.
I'll be taking a few.
Yes.
Hello. Yeah. First of all, thanks for being here. It's really nice to have you here. Normally back in the event had the nice so it's nice. I just wanted, since you've you have a lot more power now to spread some information and get your voice heard, I was just wondering what your next projects are, if you're working on anything.
The first one?
The first and the second, and they will go.
Okay, so definitely when I first wrote the poem and when I first published the book, I was actively avoiding songs with that word. But the irony of it was that I was saying that word more than I'd ever said it in my life, because I was reading that poem. So I wasn't really avoiding the word. So it was a really contradictory time for me to speak out against something using the terms in which I was speaking out against. It didn't make a lot of sense, but it showed me a lot of things don't make sense. But in general, like when a new song comes out and everyone's talking about it, I'll listen to it once, you know, and then if I do feel like, and it's not just the N-word, if it's saying things that I just, even as good as the beat might be, if I'm not feeling the words, I'm not going to listen to that on repeat. I'll give it one shot and then I'm moving on. I haven't blacklisted artists like because they've used the word once, because you know, Erykah Badu uses the word, and I didn't realise that until I kind of went back to her stuff and I was like, I love Erykah, and then she's using it in like at least once every three songs, it's there. And I was like, so it's not just rappers, and it's just a part of our, you know, culture and society that I'm just going to have to deal with for the time being, because I can't tell people they're wrong for using it. I can just tell them how I feel about it. So that's kind of where I'm at with it at the moment. So I'm not kind of putting black marks against people's names. It's not my job. My job was just to say what I said. And now I'm working on my new collection of poetry. And I just recently graduated from, I did a master's degree in writing and teaching at Goldsmiths, and so I'm doing a lot of education work, going into schools, colleges, other universities, and giving talks and creative writing workshops, and that's a really big part of my practice, is kind of encouraging other people to use their voices to write and speak out about what's important to them. And so that's kind of where I'm at now, doing a lot of workshops and just working on my second book.
At the moment I'm developing Akin Saltfish, which is a web series I also made. I'm developing it as a full-length series at the moment. So that's taking up most of my time, but I'm also finishing off a short film commission. I'm not sure when that will be released, but that's what I'm working on right now. And then I'm also writing my first feature film. So,
busy. So, we have 1, 2, 3. I know we have 3 questions. Are there any more? Okay, we'll have those 2 and then we'll come to you. Thank you.
My question is for Dean, but maybe this is still going to answer as well. I was wondering if you have to get radical different responses from, say, the diaspora community versus the home country communities, or do you not engage that much with people from actually inside first? Because
to an extent,
that's
where communities can sort of define their identity for themselves, whereas
I don't see that much in, like, home culture. There's a question.
On the back.
Sorry, I think you missed the answer. So, yeah, very glad to see you and my question was, both what Dean and Sue said. So, the two you were saying, sometimes you think, oh, what on earth was I thinking of or talking about 5 years ago? And then also this idea that often what you produce, the art that you produce, is very much informed by race and sexuality and gender. So my question to both of you would be, do you think that there will be a time in your life where you think back and you think, wow, at that time I talked a lot about race, or I had to talk a lot about race, and that
time
is over,
or
would you want it to be that way?
Mm-hmm. Okay, what was the first
question?
The first question was about
about the diaspora. Okay. Shall we ask, start with you then?
Okay. I know your question was for Dean, but I'll just answer briefly. In terms of engaging with people in the home country, so me, that'd be Jamaica and here, I definitely think that less people are. I'd love to engage more with people in Jamaica than I currently do now. It actually does have quite a big audience there, but not as much as I would like. But hopefully with Strolling in particular, there's a couple episodes in Jamaica that are going to come out soonish. So I hope that will kind of start to address that kind of disconnect sometimes, because I don't ever want to speak over someone who actually was born in Jamaica, because I'm only Jamaican in the sense, in a disconnected sense. I was not born there. I have not lived there my whole life. So definitely think that can be, that's something I'm always wary of. And sometimes when people write stuff about me, they write like Jamaican British, and I'm like, oh, that's kind of misleading, like, because that's really what you call my grandma, who moved here from Jamaica. So what do you call me? Anyway, it's that whole thing about identity. What am I? I don't know how to describe myself. But anyway, so that's that. And then your question was about, in 5 years' time, will I think I talked about... No, like, will we kind of... Okay. I think that reality is, like, fluid, and I think that's why opinions always change. So I think 5 years' time, 10 years' time, things will change. I think I will look back and not necessarily regret things. I think I will look back and just have a different point of view, because reality is not static. Things change. So I think I'll definitely look back and maybe see things with a different eye. But I don't think I'll ever look back and be like, I talked about race too much. I think I'll look back and think that time was too oppressive, and therefore I had to respond to that, as opposed to like I was addressing it too much. Yeah.
So in terms of kind of talking to home countries, so I mean, there's two barriers, I think, for me in terms of talking to Jamaica and Cyprus. For Jamaica, it's my own fear of the homophobia there. I mean, I've been twice and stayed with family and felt very safe and secure and loved. But whenever I went out, you know, the homophobia was palpable, even if it wasn't directed at me, which it wasn't, because I kept it really quiet. I still could hear it, stuff that was said in passing, the way people acted, in terms of, like, I was at a club that was, like, quite open to tourists, and there was clearly some gay people in there, but, like, there was a lot of tension about that, and I just kind of felt really, like, really cautious of what I would do in this space if I had to deliver my work and be known. And I got an invitation to go and do something. It was a tentative invitation, but to go and do something at a university in Jamaica, and I was like, I'm not ready. So that's the kind of the barrier for me, is my own fear, and it's not an irrational fear. And then with Cyprus, I'm learning Greek because I'd really like to go there and like actually deliver the work in Greek, and so I'm learning to read, write and speak Greek, and I think that's going to be when I feel really confident, when I can go and share the work with my own translations of my poems and maybe new poems written in the Greek language. I think that's going to be really a pivotal moment for me in connecting with that part of my culture and family. So that's something I really feel passionate about doing. Obviously there's English speakers in Cyprus and Greece, but I just really like to take the work there with the language, because I think that would be really really great for me and for the understanding of the work. And then will I think there's a time when we've talked enough about race and gender and sexuality? Probably not. Like, my sister's pregnant, and she found out yesterday that she's having a girl. And my mum got really excited about buying dolls and stuff. And I was like, are we going to gender this child so much? Like, she's not even born. And it just made me think, you know, what is this next generation inheriting a world that is less gendered or kind of heteronormative? And I'm not sure, you know, I'm not sure. We kind of, for those that are aware of it, yeah, there's a lot of progress, but... on an everyday kind of basis, when we find out we're having a niece, everything is pink. Like, and it's like, why is everything pink? So it's that kind of idea that, you know, in theoretically things are getting better, but in practice, a lot of the time, we're just lazy about a lot of these things. Unless it kind of, like, I know my family, my Cypriot family, were quite racist until they had mixed race children, you know, but it was down to not knowing any black people. And so I think it's just about, in London, we're really kind of lucky that it's so diverse, but in other parts of the country, in other parts of the world, there's so much work to be done in all these areas we're talking about. So, so much work.
We'll take the last question and we'll have closing comments and response.
Thanks for the talk, and I'd like to draw something from the lecture we had today on the importance of media and globalization. You know, in the digital era, everyone like wastes basic devices. Everyone can be a producer or a writer and put their words on the internet. So the real dilemma is the distribution. So how to reach a large audience and even attract big media corporations like BBC and Channel 4? So would you like to share your stories?
For me, I don't really have an answer. I personally just tend to try and do things the most organic way. So I don't think I've ever really sat down and like tried to create like a master plan, because I think, I don't know, just, I mean, when I think about it, I feel like it just feels really horrible. Like, I feel like trying to like get an audience sometimes, like, because I'm trying to manipulate people into liking me that wouldn't really like me. So I tend to just try to, I think I've just been lucky. I've shared my work and organically an audience has kind of gravitated towards it. And I think that's, I don't know, I think it maybe speaks to maybe the work itself just being quite honest. I think when something's honest or someone's honest or genuine, I think you just tend to gravitate to it, as opposed to when someone's trying to kind of construct like this kind of thing that you're meant to, and like to try and lure you in. So for me, just being honest, being true to what it is you're trying to create, that's the best thing. Like in terms of like what I would watch or things that attract me, I'm attracted to things that feel right, not things that like have all the check all the boxes in terms of what one would like think would attract people, if that makes sense. So for me, it's just about being honest and like genuine, I think. But I could be really naive and like
well, no, I feel like also with your work, Cecile, it's very clear what each episode, for example, of Strolling is about, because you put it in the title, you kind of put keywords in the title, so people might be attracted to look at one over the other if they're interested in feminism or digital, or do you know what I mean, if there's a word there that draws their attraction, like will attract them. So I think being, you know, clear about what your work is, whether it's how you title something or if you do share it to people, like who you're sending it to. But I think, you know, there's so many projects out there online, like we've said, millions of them. But then there's so many, probably billions, that are not, because people aren't confident enough to put it out there. So the first step is the kind of confidence to put your work online, and then to feel, you know, proud enough to kind of share it with some people. I mean, I don't always wait for people to find my work. I'm happy enough to tweet it to them or email it to them, or, you know, direct message them on Twitter and then say, will you tweet this if you like it? Or, you know, I'm not, if I'm proud of something I've written and, you know, think it needs to be heard, I will email you, text you, like, and, do you know what I mean? I feel like I don't mind pushing it out there a bit, because if it's if people don't like it, they'll ignore it. If they do, then they'll share it, and that's enough for me to just to know I made my best effort to get it out there.
Brilliant. So we have to finish here, but I'm very glad to have chaired this session, and I want to thank our speakers and our audience.